Yeah, Ford. They appreciated that nice long tape that you sent us a few days ago.
Just back from the movie. I'm in my hooch now, and it's almost 10 o'clock. And I got a tape from you yesterday, so I thought I'd spend a little time here and just talk to you about some of the things that you mentioned. Fred Windorf, while I can't say he's an old friend of mine, at least I've known him fairly well. I've met him on several official occasions in archaeological meetings, and I visited with him, I guess, three or four times on different occasions. When he was at Tech, I think, in addition to being a professor of anthropology, he was also affiliated with the museum there. And he went from there over to be director of the Museum of New Mexico at Santa Fe, which is a pretty good museum. And he was fired over there because he wanted to be, I don't know exactly what it was, but he was the director and he was trying to take over the whole thing, and they very politely got rid of him. And from there he went to SMU, where he got on the Aswan Dam project. But he's an extremely ambitious individual, particularly smart. He's the one that excavated and wrote the book on the Midland discovery, the Folsom Man from Midland. And he's got a number of books out on archaeology and anthropology both. But I haven't seen him in several years. But I imagine you enjoyed his speech if you went to listen to him. I agree with you that Texas Tech made a terrible mistake by turning him loose, but I suspect there was a little politics involved in that. Last time you sent me a tape, you discussed in detail the Yellow House Ranch and so forth. There's no boy that lives there in Temple by the name of Lee Ash. He's a high school counselor at one of those schools. Peggy can tell you where he is, but he was raised down in San Angelo, and his mother and father still live down there. He and I went out to the Yellow House Ranch and Associated Complex one day, one Sunday afternoon when the wind was blowing, and this was long before I met you. I've flown over that country extensively out there, and the lakes that you mentioned we call illusion lakes. They only have water in them during the rainy season, they're alkali lakes, both of them. The only lake out there that has any water in it, I forget the name of it now, freshwater I mean, is over toward Littlefield. I'm trying to think of the name of it. I remember I always used to see water skiers out on that lake when I'd fly over it. It's almost an egg-shaped lake, real nice blue water. But the Illusion Lakes, in the old days, were from reading the Carter book, the water had to be pretty bad before those old boys would drink it. But I'll guarantee you the water out of that Illusion Lake was pretty bad. I guess it was wet, and that was the most requisite for drinking, more so than taste, I'm sure. But anyway, we went up and knocked on the door like you did, and probably met the same old boy, the foreman. He was pretty nice, but he didn't have much time for us that day. And we scouted around a little bit, climbing up on top, and we went in some of those caves. But this old boy told us that Boy Scouts had been going out there for years and years and years, as well as amateur archaeologists from surrounding communities there particularly love it, and that although a number of artifacts have been picked up out there and some excavated out of the caves, that they were substantially gone now. But I'm sure the way to travel that country is either by horse or on foot, and just walk up and down. Now, what Lee and I did, after we talked to him, went out to the road south there and got on the highway and climbed up on top of the hill and parked, and then we walked south probably a mile or 2 miles out across there, just looking around for rocks and arrowheads and signs of camps and pottery and so forth. And as I recall, I don't think we found anything. But I enjoyed the trip, and one of these days I'd like to ride horseback across that country. Well, I know that's historic country, and I agree with what you said about it. It's there's something about it that's intriguing to me. It's good to hear that you made it down to Camp Cooper, and your description of the Putnam episode was most enlightening. That's something I've always wanted to do, is get around and meet those old timers. And that's where I'm sure you'd be interested in Ernest Ingehue. He's got relatives all over that part of the country. And he used to know an old boy up in on the Guadalupe River out of Nui Brownfels that by the name of Nawatney. There's an Indian camp in Selma, Texas, where the river made a bend there, and a big high limestone bluff on the south side of Cibolo Creek. And in 1926 or so, during the WPA days, old Nawatney hired something like 50 Mexican laborers and went into this Indian camp and dug it up, looking for arrowheads and spear points and so forth. And I heard that he took 75,000 out of this Indian camp. Ernest Ingehue used to know this guy. He's dead now, but when I got to Randolph Field in 1956, I used to scout out looking for these places, and I came upon old Nawatney by accident. And he lived in an old wooden house up on the Guadalupe River. It was a real nice, quaint little old place. He had a lot of money. As a matter of fact, he told me when I saw him, he was, I guess he was in his middle 80s. But he told me that he had just recently, within the last several years, sold his collection of artifacts to a millionaire that was going to retire and open up an old country store and Cracker Barrel type operation and gas station up in South Dakota. And he paid him a dollar a piece for his arrowheads. And I think he told me he had a collection of 75,000. But he was the fellow that I told you about one time, as I recall, that whose father was in the outfit that marched Geronimo from, I don't remember whether it was from Arizona to Fort Sill to Fort Sam Houston, or whether he went from Arizona straight to Fort Sam Houston. Anyway, his father was in that troop of cavalry that was involved in that, and old Nawatney had Geronimo's canteen, a rifle, and I don't know what all he had, but he had five or six relics from Geronimo. And of course there were articles published down in San Antonio papers that I've read that described old Nawatney's artifact collection, including the Geronimo stuff. So he had a fabulous collection of stuff. And when I went to see him, it was on a Sunday afternoon, And he invited me to dinner, he and his wife, quaint old people, extremely interesting to talk to. And he, out of his whole vast collection that he had collected over a period of 65 or 70 years probably, he had three little bird points left. And he insisted that I take one of them. And I consider it one of my finest bird points. I'll show it to you when I get home. It's in my big frame in my room there. I could pick it out of 100,000 arrowheads. But out in his garden, right outside his back door, the little old wooden house is built up off the ground on stilts. And you walk down about six or seven steps, because it is the lowlands of the Guadalupe River there. And you walk out into a sandy loam garden where at one time a creek converged on the Guadalupe River. And every place, of course, where one river or a creek runs into another one at an angle, you have a sandy loam beach at the arrowhead there where the two creeks meet. And old Nawatney told me that without exception in the state of Texas, you can dig where these two creeks come together in the sand and you'll find Indian burials. And he said when he bought this property many years ago, he knew that when he started building his house and putting his garden in, that he was going to find Indian skeletons in that garden. And sure enough, he dug them up, and there were, I don't remember how many he said, but there were a number of them in there. So he was satisfied that he had found them, and he buried them back and put his garden right on top of them. And it was a real interesting tale that he had to weave for me there. I enjoyed it. One of these days I'll take you down that Guadalupe River and we'll drive up and down it, and I'll point out to you the old Indian camps that Nawatney showed me. He also mentioned several that were across the river, and there's no bridge along there any place, and to get to it from the other side you have to drive through an old caliche pit area owned by some mining company, and they won't allow anybody to go in there. But he said for years he's been crossing the river there. He said he'd take his pants off and wade across the river about waist deep and put his pants on and walk up this little old creek about half a mile or so and dig in a beautiful Indian camp up there. And I know exactly where it is, although I've never been there. One of these days we'll go down there and take a look at it. But getting back to Ernest Ingehue, I'm, of course, as interested in that Mackenzie stuff as you are, thanks to you, but I'm going to write Ernest here one of these days and ask him what he's got exactly. And if you ever get down that way, be sure and go see him. As a matter of fact, you might just drop him a note sometime when you get a minute. And maybe since he's not doing anything, he's retired with plenty of money, maybe he'll be coming through Lubbock on one of his forays. I know he goes to Mexico City at random there, I think about twice a year ordinarily. The caboose sounds great, but like you say, I don't know how you'd ever move the thing, but it'd be a tremendous thing to have out parked someplace on out in front of the museum or out on the side. Gee, at Christmas, boy, what a game room or a den or even something for the kids to play on. You could fix it up and paint it and restore it, and you'd really have something. I wish you'd think about buying it with all your vast resources and connections there. I'm sure you could work a small deal like that. I envy you the trip to Camp Cooper, but maybe we can wander back down there when I get home. My mind's absolutely made up that when I get back, I want to take a trip down to Fort Brackett Fort Clark at Brackettville. The only time I was there, of course, was before Peggy and I were married. And Peggy's got some old pictures that we took down there. Sometime when you're over there, you might ask her to drag them out. We were young people in those days, and that was a fascinating place for us. Peggy's mother's sister married King Brown, who was one of the Brown and Root Browns that own three quarters of Texas, the Gunner Hotel, the Driscoll Hotel, Fort Clark, and I don't know what all. They build dams and pipelines for 2,000 miles and that kind of stuff. Of course, they all live in Houston, and they just about run Houston politics and even state and federal politics. But we can go down there anytime we want to and stay as long as we want. They've done a tremendous job of restoring those old barracks and different buildings down there. And, of course, you know what it's like around Fort Clark. The cemetery there, I've got to see now that old John Charlton is buried there, and get some pictures and do some scouting around that country. The creek that runs through there is spring-fed, and it's beautiful, clear, cool water, and the fish are something fabulous in that creek. Now, I'm talking about more years ago than I can even recall now, 13 or 14 years. So, and maybe all the fish have grown up and died of old age, but it used to be a real nice place. And we can go down there and it won't cost us anything, and that's a trip we've got to make. I also want to go to Uvalde and talk to Mrs. Charlton if she's still around. I don't know what's happened to her. I did get a letter from Jeff Dykes, and he talked at great length about Carter and McKenzie and Charlton and so forth, and he's a genuine authority on the whole epic. And he said that John Charlton was an Angora sheep raiser down in I think it's Uvalde. Is that the right place? In your last tape, you asked about the CBU-29 with the time-delayed fuse. This, I don't know whether I told you or not, but CBU-29, it's called cluster bomb units, you might imagine, Army and Air Force terminology. And 29 is just identifies a particular type. When you can set the fuse on this bomb, it's a 750-pound bomb, and you dive bomb it, or you can drop it level. You can drop it in any 10 degrees, 20 degrees, or 30 degrees dive. And it has a fuse that you set depending on how you're going to drop it, and you want it to, the bomb blows apart at 2,000 feet above the ground, and it blows in two halves, just exactly straight down the center. It splits and it throws a number of these little bomb clusters out. Now, I don't know how many clusters there are, but I think there's 500 little clusters that are about the size of between a baseball and a grapefruit. They have little ridges on them that make them spin when they get out into the airstream. We drop them at 450 knots and they just spin like the devil. And as they spin, they arm, and there's nothing to stop them once they start spinning. You can't de-arm the thing. And each one of them has a different delayed fuse in it. They start blowing, of course, as soon as they hit the ground, but the delayed fuse makes them blow for 5,400 seconds, which is an hour and a half. 90% of them have blown in an hour and a half, and the other 10% blow in the next 30 minutes. And it's a tremendous thing to watch. Extremely fun to drop because of the fireworks. Looks like Chinese New Year's or something. The explosive charge in them is tritanol, which is much more powerful than nitroglycerin or anything. It's what all our weapons over here have in them, tritanol. The 750-pound and 1,000-pound bombs with delayed fuses really make a hole in the ground. Now, I've got slow-motion pictures of what these things do. You release these bombs at 450 knots, and it's traveling about 500 knots when it hits the ground. And if you drop it at a 30-degree dive angle at 450 knots, the thing drops 7 degrees by gravity before it hits. So it touches down at 37 degrees from the vertical. And, no, it's 37 degrees from horizontal, of course. And with a .025 delayed fuse, it goes in 15 feet before it explodes. That's traveling at just under 850 feet per second. And if it's delayed at .01 delay, then it goes in about 8 feet. But you can imagine a 750-pound bomb, and 65% of its weight is tritanol. The rest of it is fragmentation. It just flat blows up the countryside, and I've looked real close at these things when they blew a number of times, and if it hits a tree, say 3 feet in diameter, it'll absolutely splinter the thing. Sometimes you'll see a piece that's maybe the size of a wash tub, and it'll blow it 1,000 feet in the air. It's unbelievable the power that these things have. If you drop them in a high humidity areas such as fog or low clouds, when the thing blows, it's got such a tremendous shock and tremendous initial heat that it'll make it rain, and sometimes it'll form clouds that'll stay all the rest of the day just from the concussion and the tremendous initial heat of these things. The other weapons we use ordinarily are rockets. We carry two rocket pods, each one of them with 19 rockets, .275 rockets. They're just a little bit less than 3 inches in diameter, and they've got a real good fragmentation pattern. We can either fire one pod at a time or both pods at once. If we fire them at once, of course, that throws out 38 rockets at one time, and it's guaranteed to kill anything within the size of a football field, 150 yards in, or 150 yards in diameter. We also drop CBU 1 and 2. CBU 1 and 2 are loaded in what looks like bazooka canisters. It's just a round aluminum canister. They hang in six into a pod, and when you hit the pickle button, all you do is open a solenoid that allows these things to drop out at a metering type rate out the back of the wing, and you can spread them out clear across the countryside. They're designed for troops in the open or airplanes on the ramp or something like that, and it has tremendous ability to destroy something that's not protected. Of course, it won't penetrate a tank or anything like that, but there's so many of them, and there's so many of these little pellets in them that it does a real good job. Unfortunately, in the tall jungle where these things hit the tops of the trees 250 and 300 feet up, and it's a pretty worthless weapon in the tall jungle. We drop an awful lot of napalm. As a matter of fact, probably a fourth of our armament is napalm. We drop, of course, high drag and low drag bombs both. You saw the high drag bombs if you've seen the film that I sent home. The advantage of a high drag bomb is that when you drop it, the fins open and cause, like speed brakes, cause it to slow up. you can deliver it at an extremely low altitude and high speed, and it's very similar to dropping it on a parachute. It allows the airplane to get out of the blast before it's too late, and it allows you to get so close to the ground that you can identify the target positively before you drop it. When you're traveling at 450 knots, why, it's real tough to identify a small target because the things are happening so fast. Of course, the high drag bombs come in 500 and 750 pounds apiece. We do have 1,000-pound bombs, but we can't carry them high drags because when you drop one, the fins won't stay on it. The bomb just flies off and leaves the fins sitting there. A number of our bombs we drop with instant fusing, and we've got what we call a daisy cutter that we manipulate these bombs with. Daisy cutter is a 30-inch pipe that sticks out of the front of the bomb, and we put an instant fuse on the end of the pipe. So when the thing is traveling pretty fast, when it hits the ground, just under, like I said, 850 feet per second. So this 3-foot fuse goes into the ground before the fuse can react. It doesn't even know it's hit the ground yet. And when it blows, the bomb is on top of the ground, and it'll just level everything almost without exception. If a brick building were standing there 50 feet away, why, it'd break every brick and blow the whole structure down. And of course, we do it all the time. When the enemy goes into these little hamlets, the old farmhouse there, well, we drop a bomb on it, and when we blow them up, they're no longer hooches, they're military structures. As a matter of fact, a FAC had us up near Phuket 2 days ago strafing some oxen up there, and he said the VC had been using them up there to carry supplies with, so I shot 12 of them out in the middle of a pasture. Boy, and if you think that doesn't hurt to roll in and strafe oxen out grazing in a pasture. But anyway, when he gave us the FAC always gives you your BDA, which is battle damage assessment. He gave us 12 pack train units. He wouldn't call them lousy oxen. They're pack train units now that you've killed them. Before it was a cow, but it's the official intelligence way of making the war sound humane. You know, it's the same thing when you drop a bomb on an elephant. Gee, we never tell anybody we bomb elephants, because I'm sure it'd turn the public against us. So they're pack train units, is what they're called. If Peggy didn't give you that tape, Bill, that I sent her on about this rescue that we were in on up by Way, get her to let you listen to it sometime. I think it lasts about 20 minutes or so, but this was a very dramatic rescue. This F-4 had been shot in out of Da Nang in the Way area, and we were up there on a bombing mission, and they diverted us over to helping the rescue of these two downed pilots. And in the operation, three helicopters were shot down. And you can hear on the tape where one of them is saying that he just had his winch shot off, and he was vibrating real bad trying to make it back to Way. That airplane never did get back. As a matter of fact, it crashed and killed 4 people on board. But they never did get the back seat pilot, but they did get the front seat. And I sent him a copy of the tape. He's in Colorado Springs now, recovering from his injuries. And I got a real nice letter from him just yesterday thanking me for sending him the tape.